My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. That was really a crappy introduction. I'm not judging it. I'm just telling her so she knows. I come from a different school. We come from the hard school of AA, where it's tough and it's hard to get sober and it's tough to stay sober. And we say, you cast your bread upon the waters and you're going to eat a lot of soggy bread. Anyway, that's enough of that. I'm glad to be here this afternoon. I'm glad to take part in this convention. I've had a good time. I played hot potato out in the pool and got cheated by a bunch of little kids. And it's been a very nice weekend. I feel very disappointed this weekend because I've had this set aside in my calendar and turned down several speaking engagements for this weekend so I could be here, because I really like to come down here. And 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was notified by my family that tomorrow my daughter's being married in Albuquerque. So I have to leave here and go down there, catch an early plane, and go down there tomorrow and give her in marriage and look nice. And look like a bronze Viking god. But I'd rather be here. I've given her more times in marriage than I've been here. That's not true, but I just had to say it. I don't want this played anywhere around my family ever. Just the Al-Anons will snitch. But to those of you who are kind of new, I know some of you are new. A couple of you come up and asked me if I was Clancy just before the meeting. And not necessarily. Depends on why you're asking. But you may wonder, what's all this nonsense about the primary purpose? What's it all about? Well, I'll just give you a little background on the primary purpose. In the 7,000 years that there's been recorded histories of drinking, there's only been two times where there's ever been any kind of place for people like us to go, and you're sitting in one of them. And this one we take for granted. It's been going now for 62 years. Just 62 years in a couple of weeks, or last week was 60, our second 62nd birthday. And it's got meetings all over, and there are places to go, and you get drunk and come back sometimes, and some people stay here. And it's hard to realize that this is really a miraculous thing, because as human beings, if you're like me, the tendency is after a while to take everything for granted. I remember the days when I tingled with the thought that I was sober. Now I just sobriety is just something I do. There's no truism. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. It may get deeper and richer, but it doesn't tingle anymore. Of course, the example of that, I've used it 1,000 times. I don't know a better way to describe it. When guys call you and tell you about it, the worst single word any sponsor could hear on a telephone call. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. And if you're really quick, you say, oh, Mr. Emerson, not in today. He go home a long time ago. I don't know where to go, But you usually listen to it. But, oh, God, this is, I know I thought the last one was, but this, God, when I saw her walking out of detox, I don't know. We were having lunch today, and we reached for the sugar, and our fingers touched, and there was a spark, a literal spark. And you hate to have to tell them the news that it isn't going to stay this way. We wish it would, but 15-year-old excitations don't last that way. And no matter how deep you're in, one chance in a billion that your relationship lasts for more than 2 weeks, even if you should, incredibly enough, go together and maybe get married and have a couple little tykes, and it'd be wonderful. And it isn't going to stay like this. It may get deeper and richer, but it won't stay like this. 3 years from now, you'll be sitting in your little cottage, your little love cottage, and the kitty's outside playing, and you're having lunch, and you're going to reach for the sugar and your fingers are going to touch. You're going to say, give me the goddamn sugar. Part of life. That's the way life is, unfortunately. And we take sobriety for granted. And it's hard to realize how close we came to not being here. One of the closest, there's a lot of problems in early AA and getting it started and getting it settled and writing this book and being accepted. But in the early 1940s, there was a period that most people aren't really familiar with because we don't go into it much in our literature. It isn't in our book. Our book was written before that, and our literature after that didn't have talked about it much. But AA began to dissolve in the early 1940s. People were writing in from all over the country. There was bickering, fighting everywhere. People could not get along. People getting drunk, shaking their fists at one another, doing all sorts of bad things. And they'd write these letters to Bill Wilson, and he was just out of his mind trying to solve them. What can I do? Here's what we do. And his group was having problems. For example, there was a man named Hank Parkhurst, who was Bill's right-hand man. He was the local version of Dr. Bob in New York for Bill Wilson. In his office, Bill dictated the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, after a while, in the early 1940s, Bill did something that made Hank think he had been betrayed and traduced. And he got brooding about it and got drunk. And he spent the next 2 years going to all the meetings he could reach in the East Coast and saying, don't trust Bill Wilson. He's a liar and a cheat and a thief. And people were getting drunk thinking about that. You know, what? Who can you believe? Who can you believe? All over the country, there are all sorts of things. In Chicago, for example. Now, in Akron, there was Dr. Bob and his followers. They were still kind of hung up on the Oxford group. They had the four absolutes, which AA did not accept because AAers felt that we are absolutists by nature, perfectionists. We should get away from those perfectionist goals because we can't make it. But in AA, in Akron, they were kind of more a religious thing. Now, the people in Chicago, the AAs in Chicago, would not communicate with the people in New York because Bill Wilson and that bunch of people were not religious enough. They would only communicate with Akron. People in Los Angeles, the liveliest group in the country, true story, when Bill Wilson came out in 1946, they had a little meeting for him at the Shrine Auditorium, and 1,000 people, AA, showed up, and there weren't 1,000 people ever gathered together in the history of the world at Sober Alcoholics before. He couldn't believe it. One of the great advantages Los Angeles had, they were so far away from every place else, they didn't realize that there's a lot more to it than book. You know, it included bickering, backstabbing, fighting. You know, they didn't know that. We've since found it out. But people in Los Angeles would not communicate with Akron. They were too religious, a bunch of fanatics, only with New York. All over the country, people were choosing sides and fighting and bickering. Guy in Florida was my all-time favorite. They thought he was selling memberships in AA. And they asked him, why are you doing this? And he said, it's not as bad as it looks. He said, it is my experience with the people around Miami, they will not accept anything if it's free. But if they have to pay for it, they'll listen. And I don't keep the money. I send it into New York. And all over the country. But one thing that was happening is this. The flush of the Saturday Evening Post article had gone over. Most of the authors of the stories in the first edition of the big book were drunk. It was going downhill. And the guy in North Carolina wrote Bill Wilson a letter saying, you know, Bill, we're going to become extinct. We're going to go the way of the Washingtonians. And Bill Wilson never heard of the Washingtonians. Who the hell are they? So he stopped and went to the library and discovered a most startling fact. In the 1840s, there had been a movement similar to AA, much, much more successful than AA, that had grown beyond any expectations of size. It started with six guys in a bar in Baltimore, drunkards trying to help each other. People all laughed at them. And little by little, they got another little group, and they got a little group in Philadelphia, a little group in Washington, a little group here and there. At the end of the year, they had several hundred sober members. The end of 2 years, they had maybe 2 or 3 or 4 thousand members. By the end of 5 years, they had 200,000 members, which may not sound like much till you think that AA, after 5 years, had about 1,000 members. And they didn't have any telephones or any radios or no mass communication, just people talking to people. And he studied their movement and he thought, how could such a wonderful movement become extinct? And he read some histories of it. And he realized they had a series of problems that they had attempted to solve, or not problems exactly, but they had a point of view. That some of their, they depended a great deal on some of their very wonderful speakers. And when these speakers got drunk, a number of people lost confidence. But probably the number one reason was this. In 1845, the Washingtonians were the first and most successful treatment for alcoholism in the history of the world. And in 1845, about 1845, their leaders got together and they said something which sounds kind of, doesn't sound silly, because they're all, AA is full of people saying the same things. If we can help drunkards, we should help all sorts of people. People with all kinds of problems. We should help narcotics addicts who are not drunkards. They didn't have narcotics the way we now have heroin and cocaine, but they had things like laudanum and opium. He's waving at you right over there, ma'am. Poor hunchback lady. Go ahead. I told you to ring those bells. Anyway. Well, let's see. The name of the hotel is the Esmeralda. That's why they wind up here. Yeah. I don't suppose I'll ever be back here again, so I better make this a good one. There's my wife's personal spy in the front row. And they decided to put their good force to work, this great thing they had, this symbiosis. They didn't have the word then, but that's what it was, the symbiosis of the sum being more than the parts. And some of them got involved into helping narcotics addicts, and some got helped in people with emotional problems. A great many of them got into working with temperance movements in the efforts to stamp out the sale of drinking, sale of alcohol. Some of them got into political arguments. Some of them got into the anti-slavery movement. Some got into trying to find a way to get Texas, part of the United States, away from the claims of Mexico. All sorts of things. They had this wonderful thing to get it together. And they put all their juice to work. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct. And with very few exceptions, they all died drunk. And there was a book written in 1861 that I have. It says, the man was talking about, he can't understand what happened. Just people seemed to lose interest after a while. And they didn't come around, and sometimes you'd hear they got drunk. Now, you know they were extinct when Bill Wilson, the guy who had founded the second, although he didn't know it was the second effort of drunkards helping drunkards, discovered that there had been a movement almost like his exactly 100 years ago. And they had gone down the toilet. And he read about that. And he read about these letters. And he read about these things. And he read about the problems people were having. And he thought about it. And he watched AA slowly shrink. Slowly shrink. Just like watching water run out of a broken glass. And in the mid-1940s, he sat down and with every, in one final gasp to save AA and its spiritual goals, he wrote the 12 Traditions. A lot of people think the 12 Traditions were just came out when the book did. 12 Traditions came out years later when AA was dying. And it was an effort to get people to, it was an effort to make people survive, to enable people to survive. And he wrote them not in the form we usually read them in meetings. He wrote them in the form of the long form. Some of you may not be familiar with that. In the back of the book, there's a short form on one side, the long form on the other, where the same traditions only are fleshed out. And everyone should understand those because they really tell you what the traditions mean. In our group in Los Angeles, the Pacific Group, we have 1,000 people sit quietly the second Wednesday of every month while we read the long form of the traditions. We want people to understand them. People say, well, our people won't sit still. Well, you tell them they better sit still or they won't be sitting at all, maybe. And that's the interesting thing. He introduced these traditions one by one in the grapevine and ran across something that we all are familiar with. He didn't know it at the time. There's one basic problem in AA, one basic flaw. Always has been, always will be. It's made up of alcoholics. Damnedest bunch of pukes that ever came along. And many of the AAs refuse to accept them. We don't want traditions. We don't want rules. We came here to find love. And I found it. If you get in my way, I'll kill you. Yeah. So for the next few years, some people in AA had the traditions. Bill Wilson traveled around the country. One of the reasons he came to Los Angeles, in addition to visiting his mother. Incidentally, I want to say something in passing. It's got nothing to do with this subject, but I ran across it yesterday. Somebody's again asking me for a donation to the Wilson House up in East Dorset, Vermont. And I have no objections to people giving up money to the East Dorset House, Dr. Bill Wilson. I've visited there, and I've visited Bill's grave and so on. But I have to kind of laugh when you stop and think, Bill Wilson hated that house. He got out of there as fast as he could and never went back. And as soon as he had some money, he moved his mother out of there and moved her to San Diego so she'd never see it again. He had nothing but bad memories. And now we're all going, let's all go visit Bill's house. If Bill were here, he'd say, you go ahead. I'm not going, you know. The house in Akron has some meaning because that's where our life started, but oh well. I'm not asked to speak on that subject. But it's all right. Gives us something to do. Keeps us home writing checks instead of going to meeting. But he went around trying to talk up the traditions, and there's a lot of beefs about it. In fact, by the late 1940s, there was such a series of problems that he and the co-founder, Dr. Bob, thought if we could only get some of these divergent factors together, they might see that we're all on the same side instead of this continual bickering, which is why they formed the first AA convention. Not for any purpose other than to get people to see that they're like others and that we have a community of interest. And so Bill and Dr. Bob asked their followers to find a place for it. Unfortunately, the followers didn't get along either. And the people in Akron said, we'll go to a convention. We won't go to New York with those high binders. And the people in New York said, we'll go to a convention, not with those people from Akron. And there are four absolutes. So Bill and Dr. Bob had to get together and solve it themselves. Cleveland. So we had a convention in Cleveland in 1950, 4th of July weekend, near the 4th of July. The first large collection of sober alcoholics in the world in 7,000 years. I have a picture of that convention. I have the tapes of that convention. They're very scratchy, but you can hear them. And it really was it's a tremendous thing. Dr. Bob, our co-founder, was dying of cancer at that convention. And knew it, and he was very eager to convey what he had learned. And some people, his son and another guy, helped him to the podium. And he desperately wanted to share what he had found. He gave a little talk. Most of us who have been around a while have heard that talk or read it. Some of you haven't. But it's an amazing thing. The three most important things he could think of to say in 1950 could be said as among the three most important things you could say here today. He said, first of all, he said, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes that may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. When boiled down to the end, our work consists of love and service. And we all know what love is. We all know what service is. That's all there is to it. And he said, secondly, let us never be too busy or too smug to stop and give the man behind us a hand and a pat on the back, take him to a few meetings, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken time to help us. And the third thing he said was as true today as it ever was. He said, let us guard that erring member of the tongue and try to remember to use it with kindness and love. Because everyone in this room has seen the example of how sometimes in our rages and our tempestuousness, our tongues create more pain than anything we could do almost. And he said this, and he died shortly thereafter with a great heritage behind him. But another thing they did at that convention, they had six young guys. They gave them each two traditions. And they got up there, and they each took two traditions, and they tried to explain. These are not rules. These are not any big constriction. These are just something so can continue to operate. And, of course, one of the great selling points is we have no enforcement even. We can't even enforce them. If you break them, we can enforce them. There are no such thing as AA police. Most sponsors wish there were. You know, I've said this again a lot of times too, but it can be said. In my area, for some reason, I am known as a dictator type sponsor. And I make people march in lockstep in between cleaning up dog poop. And I find it hard to explain to them. It is impossible to be a dictator in AA without the absolute agreement of the dictatee. Because all he has to say is, screw you. And the dictatorship is over. That's why I wish we had AA police so they could come at night. Did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us. Yeah. But they explained these traditions. And later on in that convention, they voted them in. And in 1951, the next time the book was reprinted, they included them. And they've been part of our operation ever since. Unfortunately, they get lost in the shuffle so often. They get lost in the shuffle. We sometimes read and sometimes don't read. I go to meetings all over where they don't read the traditions at all, don't even know what they are. They have those two things on the wall. If you're bored, you can read them. Or sometimes they have newcomers read the traditions to see if they can pronounce autonomous. Listen, he's an autonomous. Son of a bitch. Yeah. It's hard to realize. I think a very good case could be made, and I would always defend it, that the traditions are much more valuable than the steps. Steps are nice. They're great tools to sobriety. If I don't work the steps, I might get drunk and die. If we don't have the traditions, we might all get drunk and die. And that's why it's so important to stop it. This is the signal for involuntary applause. This is the snuffle. Isn't that beautiful? In fact, for those of you who are new, you might be interested to know that the short form of the traditions are just abbreviations of the long form. One of the interesting things is but I'll tell you, it's important to know that because there are forces around AA who continue to say the third tradition states the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Not that you have to be an alcoholic. You just have to have one drink and say, I desire to stop. Then you come have full privileges. That's what it's about. But that is what the long form says. Long form says, we want to help all recover who suffer from alcoholism. Because when they abbreviated that, they had no idea that years later there would be people trying to sneak into AA. It's kind of going past now, but there was a great movement for a while. One thing good about California, we get it first, then it gradually moves back to the boobs back east, and we're done with it. You still hear it in New Jersey now. Don't hear it out here. That it's all one big disease. Alcoholism, drug addiction, gambling, overeating, it's all one big disease. Do you know where that came from? It came from a treatment center that only has one van. So, you know. But the traditions, that third tradition also, in the first abbreviation, is kind of interesting if you're new. In the first abbreviation, it said the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. And then they begin to realize that isn't really correct. Hardly anybody ever come to AA with an honest desire to stop drinking. You have a desire to get out of trouble. You have a desire to get that bitch off your back. You gotta have a desire to hold that job. But not to stop drinking, because we've all tried stopping drinking, and that's terrible. Just like you just find a way to cut down, or maybe not smell or something, you know. An honest desire to drink, stop drinking, is what you get after you've been in AA a while. After you've done something. Yes, I have an honest desire to stop drinking. So they went back in and took out the word honest. So that's why the third tradition now reads the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Any kind of desire. But these traditions came out and people have accepted them, and they've been observed in the breach, and they've been observed correctly, and they've had their ups and downs over the years. And our topic today deals with, in a sense, a phrase, not in a sense, but really in a phrase from Tradition 5. Now, in the preamble to AA that's been written since then, it's mentioned our primary purpose to stay sober and to carry our message to the alcoholic who still suffers. In the fifth tradition, however, as was written in 1939, it's almost the same, but not quite. It says each group should be a spiritual entity, and its primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Its primary purpose. We have all sorts, and these traditions are kind of interesting. They're based on doing it other ways. They're based on the Washingtonians dying. They're based on the Alcoholics Anonymous shrinking. That's why we, incidentally, the first problem they had were so many people in AA were at each other's throats. That's why the first tradition reads about unity. That's the most important thing. If we keep fighting, we're all going to be dead. Unity. And there's no power greater than ours. We talk about the powers, or no big shots, and no these things. And they get to every group is autonomous, it says in the fourth step, or the fourth tradition. The fifth step, so primary purpose, our primary purpose, is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now, why would it be necessary to say that? What's the purpose? Are we some sort of a separate organization that we think we're different or better than other organizations? Or what is the reason for this? And I think to understand that, it is necessary to understand the nature of the illness we bring here. Now, most of us in this room, the newest comer has come to realize that we're here to stop drinking, to get away from alcohol, and then somehow to feel better after that. And only in a very rudimentary sense is that true. Stopping drinking is something that hardly anybody has ever needed any help with. There isn't a person in this room who has had needed. That's one of the great problems of people like you and me. You know, we hear old timers sometimes say things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. And boy, that's really an alcoholic. But I'll tell you something. Physically speaking, it is impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 2 straight weeks in a laboratory. The body will not permit you to keep it intoxicated if it can possibly help it. The body sets up defenses. The body, you know, you read the paper about how kids on a dare will drink a bottle of whiskey and die. Why is that? Because the body has defenses. If you take a small amount of alcohol, it affects the brain areas one by one. First brain area to be affected is speech. Doesn't mean you can't talk. You just get a little slur that nobody can hear except a sponsor on the telephone. You know, you've been drinking. No, I haven't. But you keep drinking a little bit more and you go through the motor areas. You go through coordination and balance and all sorts of things. And that's like, finally, you get up very high and you get to sight. Sight is one of the last ones to hit. And it doesn't mean that you can't see. You always have jokes of drunkard seeing five or something. The same thing happens to your eyes. It happens to your speech. They just slur. They just overlap a little bit. So you're getting two different images. They're not triangulated. So you have. That's why although we don't know why, we want to pretend to be drunk. We clown. That's how you can spot an accomplished drinker on the freeway. I mean, he's. Well, amateurs are going. And then your body won't let you drink much longer, and it'll stop the intake because you're now getting in danger. No more our body says it fights for survival. So it stops the intake. Does that by procedure we call passing out. But these kids, people whose bodies are not used to processing alcohol, by the time the body says stop, the alcohol is already in there and it keeps going. And the next area to be affected is respiration, breathing. When it gets there, you stop breathing. That's all. No big deal. Nothing magic. Just mechanical, just boom, boom, boom. If stopping, and you eventually will all stop drinking. Some people say things like, if I can only get off this drunk, help me get off this drunk, I'll do anything. I found a solution to that in 1948. Slap a cop. You're off that drunk right then. Even if you don't slap a cop, there are other ways to do it. Your body will set up a series of involuntary physiological reactions to reduce toxicity by inducing a procedure called reverse peristalsis. We call that puking. Your body's just full of toxicity. Let's get rid of it. There's hardly anybody in this room who hasn't knelt in front of an old porcelain altar in the morning and watched your body try to help you. Oh, God. Some mornings when you're sick enough, your body will reduce toxicity from both ends at once. Which is good on your body, but it's bad on your nerves, I'll tell you. And every answer must be correct, this series of split-second decisions. And usually, if you're lucky, you still have your loved ones with you outside the bathroom door saying, good enough for you. Why did you go and puke at her house for a while? But I'll guarantee you one thing. You always get sober. You always get sober. If getting sober were the answer, we'd have no problem. There'd be no need here. We'd just all go to a detox and be home free. And yet people die every day thinking, well, I got sober and it didn't help. It. And most of us fall into that terrible trap of knowing that our case is different. Because I go and hear these sober people, they talk, but they're sober and they're feeling good. Am I the only one who feels bad when I get sober? That's when my life gets out of whack. That's when my emotions get out of whack. And people want to give me advice. I've been getting advice since I was a little boy, and I'm sure everyone in this room has gotten enough advice to last you for five centuries. Just people want to help you, give you advice. If you'll only do this, and now why don't you do this, and on. And the one thing that prevents me from accepting the advice as I look back in my life is that a part of me says, I guess that's good advice, but you don't understand my problem. My case is not like yours. That advice maybe works for you and the people you run around with. It doesn't work for people like me. It's just you don't understand. I mean, part of the universal cry of every alcoholic I've ever known at one time or another. But my case is different. It's different. I can't explain why, but it's different. In fact, it's such a common thing when people say that in meetings, people laugh. And the new person doesn't know. I'll tell you, when I went to one of my first meetings in 1949, the guy came up to me and said, are you an alcoholic, kid? Because I was 15 years younger than anybody else in that room. I said, I don't think so. I'm trying to be honest. I don't think so. He goes, what the hell do you think's wrong with you? I said, I don't know. Something different about me. I'm too sensitive, maybe. He said, hey, get this. And I'll tell you something. I understand now why he was laughing. I didn't know then. And I never told the truth about that again for another 10 or 15 years. Because I did not want to be publicly laughed at in an AA meeting. And people say, what's wrong? Better tell them nothing. Nobody. That's one of the hard things you got to remember here. When people are new, they're really fragile. And they don't know that you're laughing with them because they're saying things that we've all said. They think maybe they are different and you're laughing at what they're saying. It's a very, very delicate line. You have to get them to laugh at themselves, but you have to get them here for a while to understand why they're doing it. But I know that advice means nothing to me. It means something, but I don't want to hear anymore. It's enough. And so the problem is we want to carry this message. I got a character, people who don't want to get advice. They've been getting advice from a lot of people. Why should we be able to give them advice? And that is the focus of everything we hold dear here. The thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous the single most successful therapy for alcoholism in the history of the world. Now, we discover here, little by little, if you stay here, that truly enough, alcohol is not the problem. It is something called alcoholism, which sounds the same, but is significantly different. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking, just as you'd think. But in alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking sooner or later will make it so painful you can't stand it. The thing that makes alcoholism a fatal disease is not that you can't get sober, but that after getting sober, eventually it gets so bad that drinking is preferable. And this time I'll try to watch it or do something or whatever the hell with each other. Just now, we go to advise these people and help them, and they shut you out. So what is makes alcoholism respond in Alcoholics Anonymous when nothing else does? If you stay here a while, I've always felt the thing that makes it different is little by little, I come to slowly hear and identify things that I thought were secret unto me. In fact, any number of speakers you hear say, well, I went to my first meeting, I thought they'd heard about me and was telling my story. We've all heard that. But what is it that has this, brings this about? What brings it about is that put it this way, there's only been two successful efforts to help alcoholics in the history of the world. The Washingtonians, who became extinct, and Alcoholics Anonymous, which continues to flourish thus far. What do they have in common? Nothing. Nothing. Washingtonians had a constitution they had signed, you'd sign up, you'd do all these things. They had paid speakers, there's publicity all over, and they'd get articles in the paper. You used to get drunk over that, who got the biggest article in the paper for their talk, and on. AA fought against these things, had an entirely different set of things. The one thing they have in common, they are the only two therapies in the history of mankind in which drunkards are trying to help other drunkards. That's all. Not psychologists, not doctors, not psychiatrists, not loved ones. Now, what is so important about out drunks helping drunks? You would think, what can they do? One thing, they eventually can bring about something that nothing else brings about. A begrudging understanding, my God, I think he does know how I feel. All of my life, people have come to me and saying, I know how you feel. Say, no, you don't know how I feel. You don't say it. You can't say it, but you feel it. No, you don't know how I feel. Nobody knows how I feel. Leave me alone. And you hang around here for a while. And one day some old fool comes over and says, I know how you feel. And you think, my God, he does know how I feel. And that's the first rope ever across the chasm. And pretty soon you get more ropes, and pretty soon you get a little path across there, and pretty soon you get a little road across there, and pretty soon you get an 8-lane highway going across there. But it all goes back to identification. And that's why it's so important to understand. That is why it is so essential to be an alcoholic if you're going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because you're better or worse than any other problem. It's because it is the identification. That is why members of AA, who I knew, who were also narcotics addicts, formed Narcotics Anonymous for addicts who weren't alcoholics, so they'd have a place to go and identify. That is why members of AA, who were overeaters, and also alcoholics, formed Overeaters Anonymous, so that overeaters who were not alcoholics could have a place to go and identify. The steps stay the same. That's why people who are gamblers, who are also alcoholics, formed GA. Kind of a touching story there. Most of us remember Sybil Corwin. In the late 1950s, she was married to a man named Jim Willis, one of that long chain of names she used to give. And Jim Willis was the founder of GA. And I knew him well. He was a nice guy, good guy, kind of mild even. But you go all over the world today, and Jim Willis is revered in GA the way Bill Wilson is in... I just wanted to see if you throw that in. Just the way Clancy is at the Texas Nut House. Just the way Bill Wilson is in AA. And there's another side effect of that, the poignant side effect of that, is Jim got so busy in GA, he didn't have time for AA anymore much, and he got drunk and died. And they still revere him because he never gambled again. But in AA, poor Jim, sitting up there in Oxnard drunk, but people still came from all over. You saved my life, Jim. Because it turns out alcoholics need certain therapeutics if they're going to stay sober, alcoholics of our type. Interesting thing, Bill, putting that phrase, he did not have an identification. He did not know exactly what the differences were like we know, because we've had a lot more ability to examine them. So, throughout the book, he talks about alcoholics of our type. He wasn't exactly sure what alcoholics of our type was, but he knew in his mind. And it turns out what alcoholics of our type are. Turns out, are people who lose their ability to control their drinking. But then, in addition to that, they've lost their ability to be able to live sober. Alcoholics, there are a lot of types of alcoholics who drink too much and they realize they're hurting their families and they stop drinking and live happily ever after. That's one type of alcoholic. There are some who need some, they get addicted to it, and they eventually have to go to a hospital like Chick Shadell and be withdrawn. But eventually they go to a couple follow-ups and they're okay. But then there are other types of alcoholics who, when they get sober, they get worse. And they have to drink. And those are the baffling kind, the kind that make people rip up their minds, and they point these other guys and say, look at Fred, he drank too, but he quit. Can't you be like him? And you can't have no way to tell him, I don't know how he did it, but I need a drink. In fact, most of us have been in situations sometimes where you wind up drinking to forget what your drinking has done to you. To forget what it's done to your family. I can't bear it. How could you drink after you saw what you've done? You don't know enough to say, that's why I drank. That's why I drank. You don't really drink to forget your drinking. Your drinking creates terrible remorse and pain. And you drink to get rid of remorse and pain. But what you are, you're drinking to forget your drinking. So the nature of this thing, this our type of alcoholic, people cannot stay sober. And in all these years, there's been no help for people like us. And now there's help. And the most frustrating thing, even today, when there's help available, you can't get, people, this disease is the king of denial. You said this before, but over the years, I've had four people, I guess, now die, that I sponsor, of cancer at the UCLA hospital. Maybe three. But I've gone by there over the years and sat in that hospice ward. And it isn't bad if people die. But you sit there and then you die tomorrow and this guy's gone and somebody else is there. And, I hate sitting in those wards, but that's what sponsors are supposed to do, I suppose. But I remember sitting here one day, and I had to almost chuckle myself. My guy, Ramon Pena, was dying, and a good friend of mine. And I thought to myself, I looked around that ward, and I thought, what would these people do? What would these guys do if I said, hey, got a deal for you. Would you come with me every night at 8 o'clock for a year and meet a bunch of new people and have coffee and be entertained by some interesting talkers and have some fun and just enjoy yourself? Would you do that if I could cure your terminal cancer? They would sign over their homes to you. They'd give you their car. They'd give you everything they got. Probably the worst place I've ever been in. Not because it looked bad or smelled bad, but just psychologically. It's the L.A. County Hospital Charity Ward for AIDS. Not only are they dying, but they've been thrown away by everybody. And I was in there calling on a guy, and I looked around that. No smell of disinfectant, nothing bad. But sometimes you see people with open sores. You think it must be this way to visit Molokai. Just the last century, just lepers and Father Damien going in there. I thought to myself, what do these guys in this ward say? Hey, got a deal for you. Would you do a bunch of things that I told you to do, whether you agreed with them or not? Would you, write down a bunch of things that you've always been so ashamed of you didn't want to tell anybody? And really get them all on paper and maybe read them to me? Would you do that? Even though you hardly know me? And would you listen to me when I tell you we can get rid of some of these things and put some of the things we share, you're not so different as you fear? And would you go around to some of these people that you're so ashamed that you even see and stick out your hand and tell them that you admitted you're wrong and you wanted to make it right? And would you continue maybe to find a prayer, maybe believe in some God, even though you think he's shafted you, and try to pray to that God, even though you believe in him or not? And would you try to help other people? If I could cure your terminal AIDS, they would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. Take me. But you go down two floors in that same hospital. You find a guy laying there with his liver out to here, eyeballs yellow, skin yellow, things going in his arm. And he will not go to your AA meeting down the hall because he's not a goddamn alcoholic. And it's kind of funny, except you come back next month and he's been dead for 3 weeks. And there's a new guy there saying he's not a goddamn alcoholic. Now, if a guy 4 days away from death can prove he's not an alcoholic, you and I certainly can. And that's the big battle here, because the mind seeks denial. Because to me, alcohol represents relief from an untenable sobriety. And the hope that sometime it will not turn into the chaos that drove me here. And somehow in AA, we have to stay sober some days when there is no reason to stay sober. We have to do things that there's absolutely no reason to do them, except somebody told us to. And I have to believe that person. And that person has to be somebody that I think understands how I feel. And that is identification. And that's why you have to be an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can be an alcoholic and a narcotic addict and an overeater and anything you want. But I'll tell you something else too in passing, in my opinion. It's only my opinion. I secretly feel that I speak for Bill and Dr. Bob in heaven, but I'm not allowed to say that. Take that off the tape, Rosemary. People do themselves a great disservice when they get up in AA and say, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Or I'm an alcoholic and a whatever. Why? What's so bad about that? Nothing, except for one thing. You are consciously making yourself different again. And every fiber of our being should be to be similar to. Doing the best we can, we're never going to feel so real similar. But you can't set yourself aside. You must. When you say, I'm an alcoholic, you've said it all. You go to NA meetings, they don't want to hear you're an alcoholic. They want to hear you're an addict. You go to Cocaine Anonymous, they don't want to hear you're, we don't care if you drink. Tell us about your cocaine use. And I don't want to, after all these years, I'm not an addict. But I've been working with addicts in one form or another for over 25 years. But to this day, if a person gets up at a meeting I'm in and tells his addiction story, it's very informative, but I feel nothing at all inside. It's just like watching a movie. That's interesting. That's information. What we need is identification. And that's why it's so important. You know, a few years ago, I was talking on this subject, and some of you were at that meeting, but I'll say it one more time because I have no better way to say it. Best example. When OA was new, in 1960 or thereabouts, they had a little meeting over on Olympic near the AA club. And they'd come over to the AA club, where I was lurking, to get people to come over and give little talks on various subjects. And a woman, she always liked me, because I was the only one in the world uglier than she was, I think. I didn't have any front teeth. She said, I heard you talk at a meeting. She said, we'd like to go over and, just make a contribution at a coffee cup discussion group. She said, would you like to come over and talk on obsessions? You seem to know a great deal about obsessions. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. I thought later, she never asked me to talk about the recovery from obsessions because I didn't know much about that, but I knew about obsessions. So on over there, our Lutheran church on Olympic. I told them about obsessions. how obsessions have ruled much of my life. I wove a veritable tapestry of information for these poor women, but eight old fat women sitting around a table. I weighed about 130 pounds in, so I felt pretty slick. And I sat down, and then they had a little sharing, and I couldn't believe my ears. I could not believe my ears. I knew what overeaters are, but I mean, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. Yeah. But this woman talked about eating a whole chicken and then another half a chicken. I thought, Jesus Christ. You know, have a chicken sandwich and go to bed, you old bag, you know. Woman talks about eating almost a half a gallon of ice cream in just a few minutes. I thought, oh, man. You need some kind of help. And someone over here talks about how she'd eat until she couldn't eat anymore, and she'd go vomit. Put her finger on my throat, her throat, and vomit and eat some more. And I thought, holy Christ. I can see doing that for alcohol, but food? Oh, Jesus. You know. I thought to myself, don't you shake my hand after the meeting, fatty. You know. But I intellectually knew their problem, but I did not identify with it. So it was just information. Information is all very nice, but it's meaningless. It's just entertainment. The great thing we have to offer here to one another is, that's why they say the gift we've been given. What's the gift we've been given? That we're wonderful? Not at all. The gift is that we can understand how they feel and communicate with them by talking about how we feel. I have a son who's 31 years old, born after I was sober. I love him. I love all my children. I love my son because I've got a bunch of daughters. I love them and I love him, but I think about him because he's the one in Los Angeles. And he and I were laughing on the phone yesterday and had a good time. But I'll tell you something, it's unbelievable, but it's true. The newcomers in this room, people here, for 5 days of sobriety. Some woman came up to me before the meeting and said she had 5 days of sobriety. I'll tell you something that's unbelievable. I've been with that little boy for 31 years and I've given my life for him. But I know more about how you feel than how he feels. And I've never even seen you before. Now how can that be? Not superficially, not on the surface. I know all about him. But down where we live sometimes, I know where alcoholics feel. All I have to do is look within myself and believe it. And I'm not sure how he, or what he lives with down there. And so that's the gift we've been given. And it's hard to accept that. Sometimes people are afraid to get up at meetings and talk about how they feel, how they felt, or why they're not doing so well. Because they think, I'm sure that I'm the only one who feels like they're not true. That's why we talk, we sit around and talk about how we used to be, what we used to be like. We usually can talk about drinking and what happened. We came here and what we're like now and what we're trying to do. But interspersed amongst that drinking and the recovery pattern has got to be, I felt inadequate and lost and different. And I came here and somehow I stayed here long enough I came to believe in a guy and he was my sponsor. And he got me to do things. Now I don't feel so inadequate and lost. I don't have to drink. You know, it's just, you hear newcomers talking like that, and it brings tears to my eyes. You didn't used to. I used to be very impatient. Think, oh, Jesus, what a dull story. But really, when you hear, you read all the things into it from your own gut eventually. And that's why we have these traditions. One of the most important traditions, to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Not to carry it to the people who want to stamp out the sale of alcohol. Not to engage in the terrible errors by the Washingtonians. But to little by little, these traditions are very precious. Tomorrow, Cliff was going to talk on the traditions. He's not here today, I guess. He should have been. He'd learned something. You should have seen me before I became humble. But these are important things. And you got it. People like you and me who've been sober a while have to defend them in our groups, even though it's sometimes unpopular. You can't sell out the whole group because you want to look good to some goof that doesn't know any better. You try to disagree without being disagreeable. But you must be firm. Because without this, you watch groups come and go, come and go, come and go. I mentioned our group recently. New York, most successful group in New York was the Midtown group on Park Avenue. God, it was a great group from Fifth Avenue, I guess. And people come from all over that group, and little by little, they got a secretary who's primarily a narcotic addict. They had some narcotic speakers coming in, and pretty soon the meter dropped off a little bit, but they had some more people, and then they'd have dances after the meeting to draw people in. The Midtown meeting has been extinct for a year and a half, and will never be started again. They can't imagine why. Another great example. I was in the Texas State Mental Hospital in Big Spring, Texas, in 1956. When I got sober and traveling again, I always had a deep feeling about that because I had such a series of experiences there with electric shocks and all those things. And I was down speaking at Midland, Texas, and they said, you know, the hospital's over here 30 miles. You want to go over and talk to the patients? I thought, Jesus, no. But I went over there in 1965 and talked to the patients. By that time, they had an alcoholic ward. I just talked to them. I didn't talk to the mental people where I'd been. And over the years, every time I went across the country, I would stop in there and talk. I'm the only one that ever came back to that hospital. I've talked there many, many times. It was run by a guy named Les Ross, and he retired. He's the guy that I had manipulated. And there's another guy, and he only had one arm, but everywhere you'd go in West Texas, I got sober over there in Big Spring. That Les Ross, he kicked my ass, and I've been sober ever since. And this went on for years. And after about 20 years of this, they realized, you know, other states use licensed counselors. These men aren't licensed. They have no ability to treat alcoholics. So they brought in some licensed counselors. And little by little, they phased the Alcoholics Anonymous members out. Shelby, you've run the ward good and you've done a lot of success, but now we want you to go out in the field and do follow-up. Let the people who are qualified help alcoholics. And little by little, more licensed counselors came in, many of them not alcoholics. The last time I was there in 1991, I guess, they had 20 patients on the ward and 22 counselors employed on that ward. With such a significant lack of success in all the state hospitals that in 1992 they discontinued all treatment for alcoholism in the hospitals because it had no effect on the alcoholic problem. They just could never get through their minds. Alcoholics can help alcoholics. Psychologists can't. Licensed therapists can't. Nothing against licensed therapists. Nothing against psychologists. Nothing against psychiatrists. I sponsored a psychiatrist, you crazy bastard. But he stayed sober, mostly. I'm not putting down any therapy. I'm just saying, this is our unique gift. That's why we have to remember, our primary purpose is not to do, and not to impress the public, not to do anything. It is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, because nobody else can do it as well as you and me. And we got to do it. It's AA this afternoon. In the Palm Springs powwow, wherever the hell they call this thing, is the same thing it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, conception for sobriety begins. And we must always be a part of that chain and continue to be there for they who need us. Thank you.